is The Unseen. And I'm your host, Mike Cleland. And this week I will be talking with researcher, author, and experiencer, Denise Stoner. My initial plan was to ask her about her recent work, and this would include two books. These are The Alien Abduction Files, subtitled The Most Startling Cases of Human-Alien Contact Ever Reported. And this is by Kathleen Martin and our guest this week, Denise. And this was published in 2013. The other book is from last year, from 2019, and it's titled Extraterrestrial Contact, What to Do When You've Been Abducted. This is also by Kathleen Martin, and there are a number of co-authors, including Denise. I also wanted to talk with her about the experiencer research team at MUFON. Now, during the interview, we touch on these things, the books and her work at MUFON, but most of our conversation was all about her own remarkable personal experiences. And I did not expect that. So I went into this expecting to follow one track, and we totally got sidetracked. And the interview that emerged is much, much more intriguing than the somewhat dry questions that I had written down ahead of time. This audio interview was recorded Wednesday, January 15th, 2020. Please enjoy. Denise, I want to thank you so much for saying yes to this interview. It means a lot to me.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm going to enjoy this very much.
Good, and I will too. We spoke at length. I remember sitting at the kitchen table at the Lake House after the event, the Experiencer Speak event. I guess that must have probably been around 2013 or so. And I remember, I think we probably sat there at that table for 3 hours.
At least. And that Lake House was a wonderful place to have conversations like that, wasn't it?
Yes, so for people who don't know, there was for several years running a rather small conference called Experiencers Speak, which was completely focused on just the experiencer. And consequently, the audience, as well as the presenters, were mostly people who have had the direct contact experience. And there was a two-day conference. And then afterwards, everyone went up to the Lake House, which is in the family of Audrey Starborn and her sister Debbie, who were running the conference. And that was just a half-hour drive north of Portland, Maine, in a classic New England little sweet, you know, lakefront environment, and off in the woods. And so it was actually more engaging and more rewarding, I think, than the conference itself, that hanging out at the Lake House.
I would agree with you, because everybody that attended the conference could wander around in the evening with the fire going and people playing a guitar and various tables and chairs set up so you could speak to each other. Experiencers, the host and hostess, everybody could chat, and things were shared in that type of atmosphere that weren't normally spoken of.
Yeah, sitting around the campfire. I mean, people really, no one was talking about the weather, let me put it that way.
That's right.
Yeah, so. You have just had two chapters that were included in a collection. Kathleen Martin is the editor and wrote several of the chapters herself. And the book is titled Extraterrestrial Contact, What Do You Do When You've Been Abducted? And that just came out a few months ago. And for part of this interview, I want to talk about that. But first, I'd like to ask about your own experiences. And the one experience that is covered in very great detail was the story that was in Kathleen and your book. You wrote a book together from 2013, and that book was called The Alien Abduction Files, and it is subtitled The Most Startling Cases of Human-Alien Contact Ever Reported. And your case was actually quite remarkable because it was substantiated so cleanly by multiple witnesses and by multiple experiencers within the event. And would you feel okay just talking about that for a little bit here?
Oh, sure. That was an experience that involved my husband, and my parents and friends were waiting for us. that night, and we had been taking this same trip for over 2 years, almost every weekend, and we always drove this pass in Colorado over and over again on the weekend in daylight, and so we knew it well. And it was actually called South Park. It was high desert. There was one straight shot, one road. You couldn't go off that road unless you stopped in a couple of very teeny tiny little towns. One of them was called Jefferson. And I don't know if there was 1,000 people there. I doubt it. So we were on a high mountain pass after we left Denver, our home, and we had packed. We were ready to go. The sun was shining. We expected to reach Buena Vista, which was a town just about 7 to 9 miles from where our campsite was. And we were driving. We stopped at one mountain pass. There was nothing there except it looked over the valley we were going to cross. And South Park Valley was a huge glacier valley. You could look over it clear as day and see nothing. So when we reached the place where we usually stopped, got out and stretched after driving for, an hour and a half or so, and I looked over that park, and again, I said it was high mountain desert, and I could see, strangely, a couple of big giant lights way off to my left, and I thought, I wonder what's going on there. Is that some kind of reflection? It just looked strange, but we got back in the car. I didn't comment too much, and just, I guess, thinking about it, asked my husband, what do you think that is? He ignored it. And we went down to the valley floor and headed across towards Jefferson. As we did, I saw those lights coming towards us, or towards the road. We passed Jefferson, and about 4 miles outside Jefferson, those lights were now approaching the road, the highway. Because of the time of day, coming towards evening, there were no trucks, no cars, no one else on that road. And those lights came over the car. I rolled down the window. It was a beautiful evening. And I looked up and noticed that those lights were attached to a huge vehicle of some kind. And then I looked at my husband and I said, what's going on? Well, he was facing forward. His hands were frozen on the steering wheel and he wasn't responding to me. And on either side of the road were great big snow barriers made out of wood and also to stop any tumbleweed, which got huge at certain times of the year. And that, when it got dark at night, would prevent any accidents from the tumbleweed or snow from blowing across the road. So here I'm looking, my husband's not responding, and the car starts to move to the left. It did not turn to the left. The car was moving to the left with this big object over the top of our car.
And you remembered this consciously?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
This was a very eerie point in the description in the book, that sliding sensation of sliding sideways.
Yes, it was, because the tires were scraping to the left, and I knew that. I could hear it. And the car lifted up, and it lifted over the snow barriers and went moving into the desert off the road, off the desert floor. And it kept going and moving, and at that time it wasn't much off the road, but it was several feet in the air, and it moved far, far out into the desert, and then landed. And at that point, this object moved over the front of the car and came down in front of us. And when it did, all my memory blocked. I did not realize what happened until we came to, I guess you would call it that, on what is called Trout Creek Pass, on the other side of the valley. Now, my husband had set the odometer, and when I looked at him, he was then awake. It was then pitch dark, should not have been. A lot of time had passed. The odometer had not changed at all, and it should have. It should have shown several more miles, showing we had traveled across South Park. We were now on the other side of the valley, on the other pass. It was dark, and I asked him what just happened. How did we get here? The engine was running, his hands were on the steering wheel, and we pulled over and started to figure out what in the world just happened to us. We were afraid, but afraid of what? He didn't remember anything. He was just completely blank. All he felt was the fear. And I had been abducted as a child, so the first thing I thought was, had we been abducted? Was that a UFO? And then I remembered my parents waiting for us. So we decided we better keep going. We didn't see anything. We drove on into our campsite. And when we pulled in, my parents, a longtime family friend, were walking down the road towards the ranch building because we didn't have cell phones back then. They were going to ask to use the phone. They were going to call hospitals and police departments and so forth. They had come in from Colorado Springs, connecting with the only road to the one we were on, only quite a bit further down. So my dad and a friend were going to get in the car and start driving to try and find us in case we'd been in a wreck after they made the phone calls to see if we were in a hospital or if anything had happened. And they saw our headlights turning in and immediately came up to the car. What happened? Where have you been? What's been going on? And the only thing we could say was, we don't know. We absolutely don't know. Missing several hours. And my mom was the type that always, she had a need to know. If it was a secret, she wanted the secret. So she kept on. What happened? You do too know. You have to tell me what happened. And my dad worked in aerospace, so he could keep a secret really well. And so he just said, it's okay. We'll figure this out. If it's something that's private to you, that's fine too. So we went on into our campsite, unpacked, and from there on we had dreams. I had this fear of going to sleep, of being alone, like out in the desert, places like that. So I finally found someone who became a fast friend. He was a doctor. Worked with him on hypnosis and uncovered what went on.
You listed so many things in that case that I have heard before, that I've had myself. One of them is just saying the line, what just happened? Mm-hmm. Like I'm writing up these reports and from my own experiences, like I've said that more than once, what just happened? And so that is a line that I hear all the time. And I'm sure you do too in your research.
Yes. Yes.
So that was a kind of a red flag for me. Well, not much a red flag because I mean, I'm not looking to solve your case, but I'm like, it felt like I recognized that when you said what just happened there. I just was like, ooh, I've been there. So.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it's a very, I mean, what else can you say?
What, it's the immediate thing you would say. Exactly. It is the thing that just blurts out.
Yep.
You don't have to think. You don't have to form the question in your mind. It just blurts out. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's nothing. You're searching your mind, looking for every possible answer. And I remembered the lights coming across the desert. I vaguely remembered something those lights were attached to, but it had blocked to the point that I couldn't tell you what it was.
Very interesting. Hey, we are going to need to take our very first break. For free Dreamlanders, you will hear a few commercials. For paying members, we will be right back.
Say yes to serious wonder. Unknown Country offers so much. Free Dreamland, a free weekly newsletter. Free daily news, a thriving free message board. But it all depends on you becoming a subscriber. And you get so much more. Dreamland and special interview archives going back years. Vintage Dreamland from the broadcast days. Live chats with our extraordinary guests. So say yes to serious wonder. Click on that subscribe tab on Unknown Country today.
The key, the mystery, The Wonder, now in a powerful new edition from Tarcher Penguin. Whitley Strieber updates the thrilling story with new revelations. Even the master of the key's most incredible predictions are coming true. We've discovered that there are many universes besides our own. He predicted this in 1998. He described how intelligent machines could be built. We're doing it now. If you love The Key, you need this new edition. And if you've never read it before, don't miss this beautiful book filled with true wisdom and true revelations. The Key is unique in this world. Graham Hancock says, "Consider its messages, and you'll find it has worked a kind of magic on you." The Key, a selection of the Quality Paperback Book Club, the Book of the Month Club, and the One Spirit Book Club. Available in paperbacks everywhere and online in all ebook formats. There are hundreds of charitable organizations in the world, but you have to have a sharp eye to be sure your money is going to where it's needed and not into the pockets of overpaid administrators. That's why Whitley Strieber and UnknownCountry.com support the Mercy Corps. It's non-sectarian, it's lean and efficient, and it goes everywhere on earth that people are in need. When you contribute, you can be sure that most of your dollar goes right to the homeless, the starving, and the desperate. Go to Unknown Country and click on the Mercy Corps Foundation ad on the left side of your homepage. A $10 gift can put food on a child's plate and shoes on his feet. Unknown Country and Whitley Strieber receive no compensation from the Mercy Corps.
We are back on The Unseen, and I am talking with my guest and my friend, Denise Stoner, and we're talking about an event that took place in 1982, and this has all the hallmarks of a contact experience, of an abduction. And you were implying just before the break that you sought out a doctor and then went through hypnotherapy. Is that right?
Yes. In this case, I did go through hypnotherapy, and it was, I don't know what you would call it, but I saw an ad in the Denver newspaper. A doctor, Romack, was looking for people who were good subjects for hypnosis. And he was wanting someone to come in or people to come in to be tested. So I called him and I went in and I was a very good subject. So he took me in immediately.
Let me interrupt. So this had nothing to do, the ad had nothing to do with UFO contact, and your initial meeting with him had nothing to do with UFO contact?
That's correct.
Okay, very good.
He was working to see how he could help people in pain control. That's what he was working on. And I went to see him, I think it was twice. And I really liked him. And I finally got brave enough to tell him what I really was looking for. He immediately agreed to work with me. He had an interest in that subject, and I was not aware of it at all, so we clicked. And for the next 5 years, we worked together. And he did my hypnosis work. We found out what exactly happened that night. Everything became very clear. He taught me his hypnosis methods that I began to help other people. I saw what was going on. I saw the entities that took me into the craft, what they did there. He worked on the fear factor with me, took that away so that the interest became so strong in me to work with others that I continued my work after we left Denver and came to Florida, and I became a certified hypnotist myself using a forensic method. And that's where we are now.
So what emerged under hypnosis? What became of the story once you could use hypnosis as a tool?
Well, what emerged was the fact that out in that high desert, I was taken into a craft. They put me on a table. I was examined. I was had something inserted that I think was back then their lower technology item, and it was very, very painful. It was some type of wire. I was screaming in pain, but this ET, a gray, that I realized later on was with me every single time I was taken, from a tiny child of 2.5 all the way through adulthood, it was the same one, would touch me on the forehead, and any pain I was going through was taken away, along with fear. And later on, oh gosh, I'm trying to think how old I was then, but many, many years later, that object came back out through my foot. And thinking it was an infection, I felt with my finger this raised mound here in Florida, and it ended up being a piece of that wire that had been inserted, and under hypnosis I remembered it being placed.
And then did you keep the wire?
I did not. I didn't ask for it because the doctor removed it. I had an infection, so I wasn't thinking straight at the time. And maybe there was something placed into my memory that I should not or would not be allowed to have it.
Very interesting. Now, 1982, I'm thinking this is, I guess, the Interrupted Journey would have been published, which had a little bit of medical activity in it. I guess that there was a point in the story. Were you familiar with that book in 1982?
I was not familiar with any of those books. I was working full-time for National Park Service, and I was busy with our daughter, and so I wasn't reading much of anything regarding that type of issue, if you want to call it that.
Okay, yeah, so that's interesting. So you came up with a story before the, I guess, presently, if you like went into any shopping mall parking lot anywhere in America and asked people to describe UFO abduction, they would describe someone being put on a table and having a medical exam done. It's just part of our collective consciousness at this point. So this, in 1982, would have been before that, before it entered our present, I want to say understanding, but almost like the simplistic understanding, because I think there's a lot more going on than just that.
Yes, I wasn't exploring that at all, and I had begun to work with Dr. Romack on hypnosis in several different areas. I had joined a team there who would go out to homes that claimed to have spirits, hauntings. We were also working as a team who were using our mental capacity and capability to look for missing children.
Oh, so you were actually using, like, you were using psychic means to look for missing children.
Yes.
There's 1,000 questions I have on my, right now, as far as what to ask next, but, so how would you rank your psychic abilities?
My psychic ability became very, very strong after that episode in South Park. And when Dr. Romack and I formed that team that we had, it was amazing some of the things we were able to do. We would get together at least once a month. Dr. Romack has passed away. He passed away suddenly. His wife went shopping, came home, and found him. He had passed of a heart attack on the floor in their living room, which I had been in touch with him even after we moved here. We were very good friends. And the team had split because we were getting very emotionally upset at doing that. You can only do that type of work for so long before it gets to you. The ghost search, going to someone's home and seeing entities, we did nothing with the negative factor. It was all kind of mischievous type ghosts, family members who didn't want to leave, owners of homes people had bought. The original owner was still there hanging on, that type of thing, and freeing them of those spirits, asking them to leave, go to the light, that type of thing. But we had some pretty good spirits and asking them to show themselves, and several times they did.
So it was you that was seeing the spirits, or could Dr. Romack see them also?
Everybody.
How fascinating.
Oh, he could see them also. Many people in the team could see them. I'll give you one quick example. We were called to a home who, when you walked into the foyer, there was a loft with a ledge above where the owners wanted to put little plants and decorations, and the little ghosts would stand at the top and push the items off onto the foyer floor when people walked in. I don't want to use the word tricksters because that can be bad, but they were jokesters. So we walked in, and sure enough, down came a plant and two other items. So we went in and we talked about what was going on, and we continued to ask. There were three of them, spirits, family members who had lived there, if they would please show themselves. And we were there for about 3.5 hours, and there was a room, an offshoot of the living room, and all three peeked around the corner at their relatives, and they saw them. So they had died in an accident, so it was like a death that really wasn't meant to be.
All three of them at the same time?
Yes. So there they were, peeking around the corner, smiling. And we asked them to please say goodbye, go to the light. We sent them away, and the family was very happy about that. So that was one instance that we attended their farewell. It was really, really a nice time, but they were just rattling things. It was not poltergeist activity. They were just having fun, they thought, knocking things off that upper shelf.
So here, what's the difference between a ghost and a poltergeist?
Poltergeist it's called a mischievous ghost, and they're not really ghosts, they're energy. They use energy from any source they can get. And mostly it's if there's a teenager in the house who is full of energy and is probably having, you know, emotional situations going on, they can have a lot.
Yes, I remember being a teenager, yes. So.
Oh, okay. So if they're having problems with their parents or things going on at school, a whole combination of things, and the energy is just boiling over, they can have this type of poltergeist use their energy to start moving things around in the home, tossing books off shelves, breaking glasses, opening and closing cupboard doors, just demolishing the place. And it can get worse before it gets better. And working this teenager, and that's just one example. There are many. A poltergeist is not a spirit you can send to the light.
Got it.
So that gives you an idea, yeah.
Got it, yeah. I knew the answer to that, and I was just wanted you to clarify it for the audience. And so what happens often, and you've probably encountered this, is that people who have UFO contact experiences will often, in the aftermath, have poltergeist experiences in the home. And given your definition of what a poltergeist is, one could assume that their energy got ramped up because of this highly charged experience of UFO contact.
That is possible. But then we have to remember, and you probably know this too, is that spirits of any kind need energy to manifest, even if they manifest as a spirit orb. And that's what they're able to do in many cases. But they'll use energy from your lights. They'll turn your lights off and on. That's why some people who have been abducted can walk up and down the street and turn your street lights off and on. My husband could do that for a long time.
And I went through a phase where I felt like I could do that. And it scared me. I didn't like it. I actually went through a point where I remember driving down the highway. I was with a friend who had also had contact experiences.
Uh-huh.
And we would drive under the lights and I would point at them and they would go off. And I would point at them and they would go off. I did it, I think it happened 2 or 3 times. Like, we had noticed they were going off as we were driving by them. And then when I started pointing at them, it was like some scene out of Bewitched or something like that. They would just blink, go out, blink, go out. And I think I did it twice. And then I was like, it scared me. I didn't like it. And I stopped. I mean, everyone says, wow, that's awesome. And like, oh, it was an unsettling feeling to do that.
Ah, okay. That's interesting that you felt that way. But then I suppose you would wonder, you know, what else could happen? What else could you do if you extended that?
Yeah, it's you talk about like the paranormal. It's all nice in the abstract, but in the moment, it can feel really unsettling. So, I mean, it wasn't like I was terrified or anything. I was like, ooh, I'm not going to point at those lights anymore.
And it would have worn off by itself, that it tends to, after a period of time. Can be weeks, could be a year. I don't recall how long it was for my husband. It was quite some time.
We can explore all of that. Let's take our second break here, and then we'll come back, and I want to ask some more stuff about hypnosis.
All right.
For free Dreamlanders, you will hear a few commercials. For paying members, we will be right back.
Ever wonder what the Close Encounter experience is all about? Think you know what it's about? When you open Whitley and Ann Strieber's Immortal Communion Letters, you're going to experience a whole new vision, not something being told to us by researchers and theorists, but the actual testimony of people who came face to face with this unknown. Unforgettable. And the book is only $3.99 at Strieber.com.
Did you know that pet dogs are routinely stolen from their homes in Thailand and smuggled to Vietnam under atrocious conditions, and then slaughtered for food? Worse, the slaughter is brutal because it's believed that it makes the meat taste better. Of course, there are many larger problems in the world, but not to these dogs, and the Soy Dog Foundation is there to help them. Dog has given man everything he has to give, heart, soul, body, and mind. When he calls to us in need, we have to answer. Go to unknowncountry.com and click on the Soy Dog Foundation ad on the left side of the homepage. A $10 gift today can save a dog from this terrible suffering tomorrow. Unknown Country and Whitley Strieber receive no compensation from the Soy Dog Foundation.
Earthfiles.com is Linda Moulton Howe's great website offering news of the edge of science and reality. Keep up with Linda's work every single day on Earthfiles.com. Whitley Strieber became the host of Dreamland in 1998, and he's still the host today. One of the first podcasts, Dreamland has been built into the premier program of its kind, exploring the edge of science and reality. The show's archive on unknowncountry.com dates back to 2004. Dreamland is a treasure unique in the world. Help keep us on the air by subscribing to unknowncountry.com today. Go to unknowncountry.com and click on the Subscribe tab. Dreamland, where wonder is spoken.
We are back on The Unseen with Denise Stoner, and we were talking about UFO contact and all the strange stuff that accompanies that. Before we took our break, we talked a little bit about your hypnosis experience and what emerged under hypnosis for you. Now, hypnosis is very controversial in this lore, in this subject, as far as investigating UFO contact. I almost see there's two camps. There's one side that says you're going to find the answers through hypnosis. And then the other side, there are people who are so adamantly opposed to hypnosis that they see it as like as untrustworthy, or even to the point of almost being dangerous and contaminating the entire subject. And I think you could make an argument for both, but I would love to find the middle ground in that, or where are you at on that continuum?
Oh, my goodness. Okay. First of all, I have taken many courses in hypnosis. The last one I took was in forensic method, and it was very important to me that I did that. because when you use hypnosis to uncover a lost memory, you realize that, first of all, a person being hypnotized has full control of what they're doing, what they want to do, what they agree to do. Then you realize that that person, if they feel comfortable with the hypnotist, may want to please them, and therefore may confabulate.
This is interesting, because there's some things where I recognized that I wanted to please the hypnotherapist. I said some things under hypnosis one time. This wasn't about UFO contact. It was something else entirely. Mm-hmm. But that's interesting, because I can tap into that feeling of wanting to please the hypnosis. You're in this very intimate setting. I mean, it's quiet. You're whispering.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're very relaxed. So, you know, you want to be, I guess, polite in a way and want to please the hypnotherapist. I recognize that.
Yes, and if you're trained well, and this forensic method through the guild was amazing, taught me a lot. So when I am helping someone using the forensic method, you absolutely suggest nothing. You write the script for the individual, and you ask the questions in such a way that you're just bringing up, how can I put this? The first question would be, is you have stated you would like to go to the state of Connecticut in the month of, and then you say, what do you see? So you're giving them not a clue. And then I might say, it's evening after 8 p.m. Where are you? So we have to guide them to the place that way, but you're telling them nothing. And eventually, they may come up with that lost memory, and then you have to decide after writing their report, and you view their emotions, which can be pretty heavy, but you've done what's called an intake. Prior to that, just like going to the medical doctor and giving him your medical information, has there been any kind of abuse in their life? What happened to them as a child? You have all this background information to deal with before you do the hypnosis. So what kind of person are you dealing with? And that can go hand in hand. They could have had the abuse, worked through that, but they could have this going on also. They could have abduction in their life and handled it. But maybe they looked at it through a dim shade, sunglasses type, and they know something happened, but they don't want to live with the fear any longer. So there's an awful lot to consider. You can't come in and say, I want to be hypnotized. The hypnotist says, okay, let's go. No, it takes me sometimes up to 3 days before we do the actual hypnosis.
Very interesting. Now, how much do you trust the information that comes through?
You have to be very, very, very careful. Sometimes that person that you hypnotize absolutely knows. You can't convince them that this did not happen. They know in their soul that it did. And that's theirs to own.
So the possibility is that I'm just playing devil's advocate here, because I'm trying to understand this. They could have had a hypnosis session. A story could have emerged, and then they absolutely are convinced that story is true. Now, the story that emerged may, on the simplest level, just might be out of order, and they could have remembered it out of order or something to that effect. Or bits and pieces of it could have been confabulated with things they've read in UFO books or seen on late night television TV documentaries.
Right.
So I agree. Yes, you have to be very careful about or I certainly would need to be, and am very careful about what has emerged in my few hypnosis sessions where I've tried to address the UFO stuff in my life.
That's correct. And, you know, the emotions, there are lots of questions that we ask, too, without the hypnosis, to see what do they have in common with others who have had the experience? What have we held back? Because we do. I do. Kathleen Martin does. Just like a crime site. So we've got something that we know and you don't. And if you spill that information, like perpetrator might do, then okay, gotcha, and we know something happened to you.
For instance, like what the light switch on board the UFO might look like.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just making that up, but I'm something to that effect.
Right.
Yeah.
Something to that effect. Something done to their body. Something, for instance, some people claim they know something. They can't get it out. We attempt hypnosis. We can't help them get it out. It is stuck there, and they have a certain specific reaction, all of them, that shows itself, and that we don't tell what that is, what that reaction is, because then a lot of people would possibly have that reaction. So we're holding that back for now.
So here's a question. This is completely personal for myself. I did two hypnotherapy sessions, one with Mary Rodwell,
uh-huh.
and that was in 2017 in the autumn.
Okay.
And then I did one in the early autumn of 2018, a year later, with Yvonne Smith in California.
All right.
I will say I consider both of those people very thoughtful, very compassionate.
Yes, they are.
Very dedicated. They have very different methodology.
Yes, they do.
I mean, I remember, like, and I have the transcript and everything. I recorded it. I made my own transcript. And they they're very different how they approach these things. But the exact same story emerged. When it happened the second time with Yvonne, it felt like, you know, when you turn on a TV show and you watch, like, oh, here's the TV show's just about to start, and you go, oh, it's a rerun.
Uh-huh.
That's the feeling I had. It felt like a frame-for-frame, like it was like watching the same Gilligan's Island episode exactly again.
Uh-huh.
What emerged, and I am very, very cautious of this.
Right.
And I just wonder, I'm going to ask if this is something you've heard before. I was on the ship. I looked down at myself. I had long fingers and a skinny body, and I was short. And I was like, I'm a gray alien. I'm a gray alien. And then I was like ushered into this conference room, and there was this kind of back and forth, like, you know, what am I doing here? Why did I turn into a gray alien? And it's like, now is the time. And it's like, what do you mean now is the time? And it's like, you chose this. You volunteered for this. And it turns out it was very, very emotional. Let me put it this way. Like when there was a point in all this where I was like, you, like I swore at him. Like I was like, you never told me it was going to be this hard. And I've told this story too many times on the show, so I won't go into it again.
Okay.
So the implication was I had lived a previous life somewhere else, whether on another planet or in another dimension or some other galaxy, and I was a gray alien in that previous life. I had incarnated here on Earth as the person I am now to perform some duty. How often do you get that?
I get it a lot. I work also with past lives, helping to recall a past life if they can't, or what they've done between lives.
This is common. What I just described is common.
Yes.
Uh-huh. That's my sense too. That's my sense
yeah,
too.
Yeah, either they've lived on another planet, and if they did, what they thought about it. I get a lot of people that believe they're hybrids.
And how do you define hybrid? Because, I mean, hybrid to me would imply that you could just go and get a DNA test and you could, you know, analyze the results and say, well, you're not completely human. But I don't think that's what's happening. I think hybridization is much more at a soul level than at a true physical level. Am I reading into that correctly?
Yes, I think so. Have you read a book called Journey of Souls?
No.
You should read that book, Journey of Souls. It's going to tell you a lot about making decisions.
Hey, this is Mike. I am chiming in during the editing. Denise mentioned a book, and the title is Journey of Souls, Case Studies of Life Between Lives by Michael Newton, PhD, and it was originally published back in 1994. Interestingly, this same author and the same book was referenced in a recent interview with Sharon Hewitt Rollett. This is going back just a couple of weeks, and this is the kind of thing, these two references within a few weeks, it makes me want to read this book now. And to make things a little more interesting, I am actually listening to one of his books on audio. The book is called Destiny of Souls. And the book that Denise referenced was the initial book in what turned out to be a series of books. Okay, back to the interview.
Journey of Souls is going to tell you a lot about making decisions. It doesn't necessarily bring up anything to do with hybrids or ETs, but it talks about decision-making and people that went to this individual for hypnosis work to find out why they're here now, how they choose, why they choose soul groups, and it's very, very fascinating. So some of the hypnosis work I've done finds people, just recently I found out, including myself, that I was involved with crafts coming where I was in a past life. And the whole town, it was actually an old mine where we were gold mining, silver mining, and they would come up over the valley and we would all run. I haven't gone so far as to find out whether or not we were captured.
How interesting. Yeah.
Yes. So how many past lives were we involved? How many did we sign up to go to another planet, possibly in between? I know I was in one. It has to do with my great love for water. But I didn't really learn anything in that life. It was just kind of an R&R type thing.
Okay. Yeah. And I've read a few books on this, and that R&R thing shows up every once in a while. We're like, I'm just going to take it easy for this life. I had a lot of trouble with the other bunch of them, and I don't want to repeat that. So Now here's where I'm at. In 2014, I did a past life hypnotherapy session with a woman named Lorraine Flaherty. It is covered in two episodes on Dreamland from a couple of summers ago, and it would be easy to look up on the site here. But I had issues of clinical depression. I'd suffered from it since I was 12 years old. I was like seeking any resource. I had tried medication. I had tried all kinds of things. And I did this hypnotherapy session. Some events emerged in a past life with a soul group that was basically my parents. And something went terribly wrong in my past life. And the implication is that the trauma of that bled over into this life in it. Manifested as clinical depression. Now, I sat up in the hypnotherapist chair and was like, I am cured. Like, I felt it. Like, it's over. I'm cured. And I'm knocking wood here. I have been healthy. No episodes for 2020 now. So that's 6 years. And I have not been able to say that since I was 12 years old. Now, so I was like, I don't care. Like, I was presented with a story that was so over the top in its imagery, and it would have made like a good opera. Let me put it that way. It was that kind of crazy. So, but I'm very cautious to trust it as fact, but I don't care. I reap the benefits. I feel like I went in feeling one way. I came out feeling another way. I have remained healthy for the last 6 years, and that is remarkable.
Yeah, and so inside yourself, you know. It's just something you know. No one can convince you otherwise. And that's when I believe the person unquestioned.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if it really happened, but I know that I reap the benefits.
You reap the benefit, but don't you feel inside, possibly at the soul level, that it did happen?
Possibly. Oh, yeah, possibly. But I can't. But I'll go crazy. I know enough about myself. Like, I'm too analytical on one sense. Oh. If I get locked into that, I'll just get stuck and I'll figure out 1,000 ways to make myself crazy. So I have to, for my own sanity, back off and say, maybe it happened. And I can't get stuck in that merry-go-round of trying to prove it or trying to truly believe it. All I can say is what I can say is I reap the benefits and I don't care whether it really happened or not.
Yeah, so you don't want to do that. Well, an example of myself. I was very, very ill when I was 20. That's 1969. And I had a double stroke. I had major surgery. Should not have lived. But my personality prior to that was let people walk all over me, not stand up for myself. Very mousy person. When I was ill, I met the person who I was in the life prior to that one. And I changed back to that personality. So that when I survived, even when I came out of that in the hospital room in ICU, people said, "Who is she? That's not the person that came in here and almost died." My handwriting changed. People think I'm left-handed, totally, and I'm not. My handwriting is so different, and a handwriting analyst couldn't identify it as me before and after. I know who I am, and I know who I changed places with. It's still me, but it's who I used to be. And I like me better. Even my husband said, you're not who you were. You're somebody else. Well, I've told a great majority of people who I am. My middle name now was my first name back then. And so there are a lot of commonalities with that person. I don't know why it happened, but it did. And I walked into, I think it was late 1970s. I walked into the house that had been mine. And I knew it. And an older woman came in to the house. She was wearing my dress in my past life. I think she recognized me.
So wait a minute. So you physically went to that house?
Yep.
So this wasn't, you weren't seeing a ghost of this other woman. You were seeing a real woman.
Right. I have a book. She autographed it for me. It was not a book. It's a brochure. And I asked her, I said, "Where did you get that dress?" And she said, "They found it in a trunk in the attic." And I knew that dress was mine. I knew it.
So the day you arrived at this house, she was wearing the dress that she found in the trunk in the attic.
Yeah.
So that's like a synchronicity. That's like a coincidence, a powerful coincidence that, like, I'm at this point now where, like, the fabric of reality, I am convinced, is, like, knitted together in order to produce these powerful, meaningful coincidences.
Yes. And so I've seen my grave, not in person, but I found it online. There are just so many things that I've put together. I don't question it. I just know it.
So you're the term walk-in, is that, would that be accurate?
Yes, but of my own self in a past life.
How interesting. How interesting.
Yeah.
Now, did you have a near-death experience during this event?
Yeah.
So you physically at a certain point died and was resurrected, or did you in a coma, or here, I don't want to lead you in any way. What happened?
No, you can't leave me because it was totally different. I was being wheeled into surgery. It was going to be exploratory surgery. And I decided I was not going to do that. I was looking at the doors to the operating room, and I said to myself, and this I figured, this is how people can leave if they want to on a conscious level. They repeat to themselves, they want to talk to the subconscious or the soul, and say, "I'm out of here." That you connect with that, and you are out. Because I decided this is no more of this. And the minute I did that, I was popping up to the ceiling, and I watched my body go through the double doors to the operating room, and I kind of said, "Bye bye, have fun, because I'm not going back." And when I said that, I saw the tunnel that people talk about, and I headed for that. It was up in the corner of the hallway in the hospital room, and I headed for it, and I was stopped. And I put what I thought. I never looked, but I put what I thought were hands and feet on the corners of it. And I kept trying to get in, and I was pushed back. And a voice. I never saw anyone. I did see a light at the end of that tunnel, and it was swirling. And the voice that I heard was very masculine, said, "You cannot come just now. You have," and this is what's been crazy, "since 1969, you have one more thing to do before you can come through."
And what is that thing?
I don't know. Still don't know.
Are you doing it right now? Are you doing it right now with your UFO research?
I don't know. Is that part of it? I just have no idea. So I started to fight to try to get in there. I thought, no, I'm done. I really am done. So I'm going in, and I got turned around, and I felt two hands, one on each shoulder blade, and pushed, and I started to fight. And I was kicking and thrashing, and I was shot through the double doors, and I saw my body beneath me. Suddenly, I opened my mouth. I went in through my mouth head first. I went into the body, spun around, and when I spun around and turned, then my body, the physical body, started to kick and thrash. I was trying to get out and go back, and I couldn't. And the nurse was saying, "You're going to pull the tubes out. You're going to pull all the tubes out." And I opened my eyes and thought, oh, no.
Now, at any point in this, did your heart stop while you were on that?
Yes. As soon as I got out, I went into shock. And they said, should we start CPR, whatever they used, what term. And the doctor said, no, we're going to be in there in a minute and put her under. So, no, just wait, because they knew it was only going to be a few seconds. And so in I went, and they did the emergency surgery. I have no small intestines. They cut out, 3 feet out of 22 is what I have left. And they took some of my stomach, and they said I probably was not going to survive, so, because I'd already had the strokes. And sewed me up and said, okay. Back then, they didn't know that we would be doing all that type of surgery for weight loss. So they figured I would die of malnutrition. It is the total opposite. So my body compensated for the loss of all that after a while.
I'm going to ask this question. This is something that Ann Strieber would have asked.
Uh-huh.
Are you a shaman? Do you consider yourself doing a shaman's work?
I have, yeah, and I do.
Have you considered that? Have you used that term to describe yourself?
No.
Okay, but you know what I'm asking, I guess.
Yeah, I do.
Okay. So, in my research, when people have had both the near-death experience and then also UFO contact, these people, from my research, are highly psychic in a way that I have recognized as a almost universal pattern. I'm sure there's exceptions to the rule. I haven't found any, but I've talked to a lot of people who have had both the near-death experience and the UFO contact experience. They are highly psychic. Many of those people are shamans, and I ask that because shaman is a sort of highly charged word in a sense, and there's no easy definition for what that might mean. So here, let me ask this. How much of your, I guess your job or so, is helping people?
I would say pretty much all of it.
That's what I sense too, yeah. The healing work that a shaman would do is no longer done by the guy at the corner of the village. He comes out of his teepee and chants or dances all night. Now the same work is done in Reiki therapist offices. It's done through psychic means. It's done through I almost want to say radical compassion.
Yeah, I do a lot of listening. and letting people spill what they have to say. What I found out I could do by accident, and it was watching TV, looking at the eyes of actors, and I could tell they were going to pass away within 12 months. And I thought, what is this? I didn't know what I was seeing. And then I started looking at humans, people here, like coworkers, and I could tell if they were doing it to themselves, if they were making themselves ill, and I did not want that gift. So I stopped. I found a way to stop it, because if they were doing it to themselves, there was nothing I could do to help. So now I'm a Reiki master. I found
I had no idea. I had no idea. I just blurted that out because that is such a pattern that I'm finding in my own work. So keep on going. I'm sorry. I apologize for interrupting.
Yeah, and then I think a lot of people do, because I ask about it if I know others that are Reiki, have Reiki, and I use my own method. After you use that for a while, you start to find things that you feel you should use. So I have used that, my own method, my own ways. And so, I think a lot of us have healing ability. And that is hard, because if the person doesn't accept it at the soul level, it's not going to work. They have to want it. And they also, it depends on their, I call it a contract. It depends what they signed before they came here.
And that goes back to my own past life hypnotherapy session. You know, like, what was I trying to do in this life that I needed to solve from my previous life?
Yeah.
Again, I'm seeing that in totally metaphoric terms, but I recognize the challenges I've been through in my life are all about, you know, creativity and my role as an artist in a way. And I've always been very uncomfortable with that. So when I was getting ready for this interview, I wrote all down all kinds of questions about MUFON and about like really standard dry investigative techniques and such. And I did not expect this much more mystical conversation to emerge.
Oh, I do an awful lot with an awful lot of things, because I keep bumping into that part of me, and then I have to take a look at it. And do I use it? I do, and most people don't know. I have some very close friends who know it, and that's it. But now I just told you.
This is what I'm finding in myself in a way,
mm-hmm.
that I have. I wrote this stuff about owls and UFOs, and what has happened is people are finding me. Like, you Google UFOs and owls, you're going to find me. So I have been collecting and archiving and trying to make sense of an avalanche, a flood of owl and UFO stories.
Yes.
And you have an owl experience too, if I remember. We talked about that.
Yes, had an owl experience, and there was another giant bird of prey. They're larger than the norm, most of these birds. You may be going down less traveled road, off a highway, or you're on a road where there's not much traffic, and a giant bird can come and literally stop you. You have to stop the car in order to avoid hitting the bird, and it will walk, well, that's what it did with us, either fly by your windshield, you have to stop, and it will continue around the side of your car looking at you. It's not the norm for these animals. We had one, I think it was an eagle, if I recall. It was so tall that while it was standing on the road, it could just about see into our front windshield.
Over the hood, or?
Yes, over the hood.
Okay, so we're talking, so that's probably unrealistic for any known eagle on the planet.
Right. And it walked around to the driver's side where my husband was. We were on a mountain pass. outside of Gunnison, Colorado. And when it came to his side, it could see in the window. And I was afraid of it. And I was afraid it was going to be another time that we were taken. And I wanted us to pull away. I was afraid we were going to kill it. I was afraid to move, not to move, didn't know what to do. We finally did drive on and did not hit it. But I don't know where it went when we drove away. It did not fly away. It just kind of disappeared from the road. Very, very strange type of animal. This can happen outside your window. You look out, and then you say to yourself, something about that animal doesn't look normal. You can't quite figure it out at the time. The bird's too big. The eyes are too big. The eyes don't look normal. They kind of shape-shift into that almond look, especially if it calls you outside and you're indoors.
Okay, the story you just told, it's a bit of an exaggeration, but I'm getting that story a couple of times a week in my email inbox. It is what you're describing. You are not alone. Now, the way I this is kind of a dig at MUFON in a way. I am saying, for my type of research, what floats my boat, the stuff that's, well, let's say, I mean, I like these kind of mystical stories, and they really have a seductive draw for me. But at the same time, they're finding me. Obviously, I put some energy out, and I'm requesting these stories. But wow, I can't tell you how overloaded I am with this stuff.
Well, believe it. I mean, they're deer.
Deer, yep. Owls, deer.
What else? There are several.
Squirrels, fox. Yeah, I've heard a lot. Yeah.
No, fox. Absolutely, the fox.
And these are all totem animals. These are all highly charged totem animals. These are these are archetypes imbued with spiritual symbolism. So,
yes.
So what I say is, when I do this work, there comes a point. Yes, it's very important to say, what time did you see the UFO? Which way was it traveling? Can you draw a picture of it? All that stuff is important. But there comes a point when you have to take off your MUFON hat, right? You have to take off your nuts and bolts investigator hat. You got to take it and push it aside. You got to pick up your shaman hat and put on your shaman hat, and then ask the question a shaman would ask.
Right.
Now, I'm riffing here. I don't know if this is right or not, but the owl is symbolic of the night.
Mm-hmm.
When you saw the eagle, was it daylight?
Yes, it was daylight. It was late afternoon, so the sun was on its way down.
Okay.
But, you know, I would discount the fact that it was going on evening. It was just there. We could see very clearly. High mountain pass, snowy. It was standing in the snow in the road. Yeah, looking right at us, very much as far as concentration.
So the eagle is a male symbol. Zeus, Jupiter had an eagle, you know, and the owl is a female symbol.
Mm-hmm.
Athena had an owl. Now, that the eagle went to the side with your husband.
Yes.
Is telling to me. So that's a... So I have no idea whether I'm right or wrong in this line of thought, but it's the way my mind spins when I'm confronted with these kind of symbolic experiences.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it draws a person. I don't know if it uses your energy, if it is able to connect with your mind. I always ask people, okay, you saw the fox, you saw the deer, because they're beautiful animals, and they are totem animals. So what did you feel? You were drawn to go outside. What happened when you went outside? You were told to follow this animal to a place in the woods or down the road where there were no humans, and it started to transform into something you didn't recognize. Its eyes changed, became almond-shaped. And then the body itself turned into one of those little grays, and it got you.
And I'm arguing, as more of the thought experiment, I'm framing this in a way that I want it to be. That doesn't make it true that I want it to be this, but I'm framing this. Bud Hopkins told me straight up the reason they people see owls is because the gray alien looks kind of like an owl.
Uh-huh.
And it does, right? It's got big eyes.
And
so I'm arguing that it is choosing these animals for their archetypal meaning. Like we have a deep in our subconscious, we all have an inner, deeper knowing of the symbolic meaning of an owl, and a symbolic meaning of a deer, and a symbolic meaning of an eagle or a fox. These are all animals with a rich spiritual tradition in folklore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they're tapping into this on that level for a reason. I can't say that's true or not, but I am happy to frame it that way for myself personally. And I think that, you know, Bud Hopkins saying it's they choose an owl because gray aliens look like owls may or may not be true. That's a clean fit, but
right.
That, why don't they just be invisible? Why don't they just, you know, magically use telepathy to just
right.
make us do their bidding? I don't know. So, okay. Here, you have shared some extremely mystical experiences on this show. You are working with MUFON, correct?
Yes, I work with the Experiencers Research Team, which is a team that specializes in those who have been taken. We have psychologists, specialists, as far as someone like myself, who I have a background in psychology. I'm not certified, but I have enough knowledge to know who to turn the individual over if they need someone, as far as a pastor or help with a doctor, that kind of thing. There are about 30 of us, a couple in the UK, a couple in other countries, and then those of us that are here. So that team I work for, and I'm the assistant state director for the state of Florida, and work cases that way. I have private cases also. And I'm the paranormal specialist for the team.
So MUFON is an organization that I would call pretty conservative. And how is this team fitting in? And more specifically, how are you fitting in with all of this?
Well, it's very interesting because that team, the research team, is a new branch that was designed and begun by Kathleen Martin. And if it hadn't been for her, this would not have happened. And that branch sticks way out. And so some of the things that we do is not really... We're still trying to fit, let's put it that way. We are still trying to fit. And once that individual that signs up and fills out our questionnaire for research and for us to contact them, and then they turn around and fill out a case management form report, and the two now meet, that is where it gets difficult, because a field investigator is out working with UFOs. And now we're working with them being taken, and how did those two meet?
And is there tension within the organization?
I wouldn't call it arguments or that. There's a bit of tension because if you get a field investigator, like many out there, who doesn't believe in abduction, they just don't think it happens. They haven't come around that far. So they either have to turn it over to another field investigator and say, I can't handle this case. I'm still learning. I don't know where I stand. So it gets turned over to someone else.
Okay, very interesting. Now, I scanned the list of folks on the Experiencer research team. There's a little list of them and a bunch of little pictures, their portraits there. And I know a handful of them, a few.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah.
I have had conversations with a few, and they've had the direct contact experience.
Yes.
So my sense is you don't get on that team. Well, let me rephrase that. My sense is that a goodly number of the people on that team have had the direct contact experience. I'm just intuiting that.
Yes.
Okay. And that is important to me because I feel they're going to be the ones who are capable of the most compassion.
Uh-huh. True. We keep taking on more because we need so much help. It's a difficult. Well, it's like, let's take religion. We have, we have Catholics and Protestants, and we have, you just keep naming it all the way down the line. How do they connect? Not easily. Not easily at all. And then we have the non-believer. How do you fit an atheist in that mix? So you could do the same thing with abductions. And trying to make this all work is really a mess. But we're trying. We're getting there.
Well, good. And I'm glad to hear that because I recognize there was a chapter of MUFON where that wasn't the case. And this is really good for me to hear. And I mean, you know William Konkoleski. I think we talked about this before.
Yes. Oh, gosh. Yes.
Very sweet guy. He's the state director for Michigan. He's also an experiencer.
Yeah.
Very, very sensitive, compassionate guy.
Yeah.
And very thoughtful. And I'm glad he's in the role he's in.
Yeah. He's funny.
He's gregarious. Yeah. He's from Michigan. I'm from Michigan too. I tap into his energy so cleanly. Uh-huh. So I know just where he's coming from. There's a kind of vibe, you know. People in Michigan are really nice. So
yes, yeah.
Now, we've gone a little long.
Mm-hmm.
I have a big long set of questions that I wrote beforehand. A lot of it had to do with the tensions in MUFON and what I was perceiving, and I wanted to double check things. I didn't get to any of that, maybe 2 minutes of that. But this has been a remarkably rewarding conversation. I did not expect it to go this deep.
Oh, well, I'm really pleased. There's so much more, so if you'd like, please have me back.
I would love it, yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful. Yeah, I'd like to come back.
Good, because I feel like we're barely getting started, and the clock ran out on us. How do people get in touch with you?
Well, basically my email, believe it or not, my website was hacked. I took it down. I haven't had time to set up another one. I'm wondering if I should, but dmsandmargaretstoner1@gmail.com. It would be nice if they hear this to let me know that they did hear this on the radio. And always fun.
Good. Wonderful. And I will put a link to both of the books that you worked on with Kathleen on the show notes. And I know Whitley just recently did an interview with Kathleen on the recent book.
Yeah.
The Extraterrestrial Contact book. And I will put a link to that also on the show notes. Denise, this has been a delight. Thank you so much.
Oh, and it has been for me, too. This has just been such a pleasure, and the time went so fast.
It does. It spins right by. It spins right by. There's so much more we could cover, and I look forward to digging deeper.
All right. Wonderful.
Thank you. This is Mike, and I am chiming in after the editing. Now, Denise and I talked just a little bit in the minutes before we recorded this interview, and we've also spoken at length in person a few times. And like nearly everyone else who has had these kinds of experiences, she has a lot more stories to share, much more than a single hour allows. Now, during the talk, I mentioned that there is a long list of people working with MUFON on their experiencer research team. On the MUFON website, there's a big long list of people. And under the headline, which is the experiencer research team, there's a follow-up line. It says, dedicated to helping experiencers of alien contact. Now, I know a few people on this page, and I respect them enormously, and I hope this team can do some good. I have talked with a few of these people, and from what I can tell, they are totally overloaded with people reaching out to them for help. I get the feeling that these experiences, these contact experiences, are much more common than anyone would dare imagine. So hopefully, in my opinion, a somewhat conservative research group, MUFON, can take this to heart and really dedicate themselves to helping these people. These are traumatic experiences. I really hope this team can help. If you've made it this far, thank you so much. Bye now.